We're going to read together in the Old Testament from the book of Numbers, chapter 20, reading verses 1 to 14, and it's around page 157 of the Church Bibles. Numbers chapter 20, from verses 1 to 14. The heading is Water from the Rock. The book of Numbers, as I'm sure you know, is the fourth book of the Old Testament, and these first four books together and then up into Deuteronomy describe the very earliest days in the history of God's people. We have the creation story, and then Abraham picked out at the end of chapter 11, the beginning of chapter 12 of Genesis, and from then on the story of God's people: Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, people of Israel in Egypt at the end of the book of Genesis. And then from Exodus onwards, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, we have the story of God's people during the exile, during the Exodus, when they come up out of slavery and journey to Mount Sinai, receive the law and the Ten Commandments, and then after 40 years in the wilderness come to the very edge of the promised land that they've been waiting for so long. And then the book of Joshua takes us across the Jordan and round the walls of Jericho and into that inheritance. So we're delving back right into the very early days of Israel and those days in the wilderness. Numbers chapter 20, verse 1. And this is the word of God. It says, in the first month — we don't know exactly of what year, because that bit appears to have been missed out, not only of the New International Version, but out of whatever Hebrew manuscript it was translated from. But as I think I'll be able to show you later, it was the first month of the 40th year after the Exodus from Egypt. In the first month, the whole Israelite community arrived at the desert of Zin, and they stayed at Kadesh. And there Miriam, who you will remember was Moses and Aaron's sister, the girl who stood by the river bank when the infant Moses was being floated in a basket, there Miriam died and was buried. Now there was no water for the community, and the people gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron, and they quarreled with Moses and said, "If only we had died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's community into this wilderness that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no corn, figs, grapevines, pomegranates, and there is no water to drink." Moses and Aaron went from the assembly to the entrance to the tent of meeting and fell face down, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. And the Lord said to Moses, "Take the staff, and you and your brother Aaron gather the assembly together, and speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. And you will bring water out of the rock for the community, so that they and their livestock can drink." So Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he commanded him. And he and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock. And Moses said to him, "Listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock?" Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with his staff, and water gushed out, and the community and their livestock drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them." And these were the waters of Meribah, which you will see from the footnote means quarreling. These were the waters of quarreling, where the Israelites quarreled with the Lord, and where he was proved holy, different from them, among them. Amen. And I trust that God will bless this reading from his word. You will know that every organization worth its salt these days will have its complaints procedure sorted out. Schools, hospitals, businesses, probably even churches, although I'm not sure that we've got anything formally written down, but many groups like that will have a former procedure so that people who are dissatisfied with the quality of the service they are receiving are able to document their complaints. And I suppose the idea is that if you receive the complaint in writing formally, you can do something about it, and it's better that your customers tell you what you're doing wrong rather than going and tell lots of other people who might, as a result, take their business elsewhere. So there is a procedure for complaining. And if you follow the people of Israel through their exodus from the slavery in Egypt into the promised land, then you can see that they would have had a good thick file full of complaints. They always seem to be mumbling or grumbling or groaning or moaning about something that wasn't the way that they wanted it. And this passage that I've picked out really from the middle of that story is just one more example. They are on their journey following the ark. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night is leading them from place to place, and they've come to this place called Kadesh where there is no water. And that's a reasonable concern if you've been camping and there's no water, or if your own house water supply is turned off, then that's a real problem. During the holiday club last summer, there was a few hours when the water was turned off, and the amount of panicking when you've got dirty children and folks needing to go to the bathroom and lunch to prepare and no water to do it with, it's certainly a justifiable concern. And here was the people of Israel staying in tents with their families to feed and their flocks to pasture, and they had no water to drink. And so they use a tried and tested complaints procedure. That is to say, they go to Moses, who was their leader, and said, "It's all your fault." That was the procedure. And what we can see as we look at the way that they complained, we can see two things about the people's complaints. First of all, that they have a selective memory. They look back to the good old days in Egypt, some 40 years earlier, that they had heard about or perhaps remembered from being very young children when they were there. And what they remember there is the corn and the figs and the grapevines and the pomegranates and the plentiful supply of water. What they've forgotten is that their job in Egypt was as slaves to build for Pharaoh using bricks, for which they were given no straw, but they had to make the bricks by themselves, and their backs were striped with the whippings of the slave masters, and they spent most of their time there doing what? Complaining to God, crying out in bitterness about the hardship that they are receiving. But 40 years later, they remember none of the problems and only the good times in the good old days. And we've all done that as well. Perhaps as we get older, we are more likely to remember the good old days of our childhood, or as we travel around and perhaps visit different churches or congregations and elsewhere in this city or other parts of the country, other parts of the world, we think about how wonderfully well they do things there, and we see the problems where we are and the blessings that other people enjoy, and with jealousy and with recrimination we voice our complaints. They had a selective memory was one part of the problem, and then they had a lack of hope. This was as good as it was ever going to get. In fact, the next thing that was going to happen to them, they confidently assure Moses, is this: they were going to die. Why did you bring us into this wilderness so that we should die here? They have no hope that anything is ever going to get better. So instead of their concerns driving them to their knees to plead with God to change things, they become simply a basis of their complaint. It's your fault that things are not as good as they once were, and we've hit rock bottom. And again, that's probably something that we recognize. Complaining is something that comes naturally to all of us in church, in business, as customers, watching television, waiting for a bus, driving along a road with a pothole, whatever it is, we complain naturally. But hope, which is one of our Christian virtues, hopes which should encourage us, console us, inspire us to be agents for change, prayers for change, and active in making things better for ourselves and other people, well, that comes less naturally. And we can often be like these people here, thinking things are better elsewhere than perhaps they really are, and thinking this is as good as it gets because God is not going to come to our aid. So we can look at these people here and we can do a number of things. We can first of all obviously condemn their attitude. They are ungrateful, undeserving, uninspiring. We wouldn't like to be with them, and they are cruelly exposed here. And we see their flaws to the full, and we despise them for their narrow-minded selfishness here. The passage is written to encourage us to condemn these people. And then having condemned them, we need to praise God for his patience, because it was undeserving, unattractive, unenjoyable people that he loved, that he brought out of slavery in Egypt and looked after and brought eventually into the promised land. And the more awful we see they were, the more clearly we see the greatness and the love of our God, that he, without anything to attract him towards them, still decides to remain faithful to them. And then perhaps we ought to stop looking at the speck in our Jewish brothers and sisters' eyes and start seeing the log in our own eye and recognize that perhaps we are sometimes like this ourselves, that we deserve the kindness, the blessing, the salvation of our God as little as they did. And yet it comes to us. And so instead of looking down on them, we should kneel down beside them and say, we are sorry for the times when we have forgotten how much we have already been blessed, or when we have failed to look forward in hope in spite of all that God has promised us. And then, having confessed our sins in confident that this gracious God remains faithful to us, the next task perhaps is to be like him in our treatment of others and recognize that they too might be bitter and pessimistic sometimes when we come across them. But our job is not to let them control the way that we react, but rather to let God shape us from within so that we can treat other people in the way that he has treated us. We live in a generation, in a world where people frequently complain, but we are the people of a gracious God, and our job is to be like him and not like them. Let me do a little bit more to place this particular episode in the story of the history of Israel so that we can see exactly what's been going on here. And you might want to flick forwards and backwards a few pages through the Old Testament to remind yourself of this, or you might know it well enough already and not need to. But the Exodus really took place in chapter 14 of the book of Exodus. That's when Moses, after the Passover, finally led the people of Israel through the parted waters of the Red Sea, which closed back over their enemies and destroyed them and left them free on the other side, free from slavery for the very first time. So that was the beginning of the Exodus after hundreds of years of slavery in Egypt, in Exodus chapter 14. The story then goes on to chapters 19 and 20, when the people travel rapidly from the banks of the Red Sea to Mount Sinai, where they meet with God on top of the mountain, and he delivers them the Ten Commandments and a whole other range of laws and rules and regulations that actually carry on being delivered right the way through the rest of the book of Exodus, the whole of Leviticus, and into the start of the book of Numbers. So we have pages and pages and pages that are spent with the people of Israel camped at the bottom of Mount Sinai, right up, in fact, until Numbers chapter 10. And if you turn to there, you will see it tells us that the people of Israel, in verse 11, leave Sinai the 20th day of the second month of the second year. That's the second year since the Exodus. So they have spent a year, 1 month and 20 days approximately at the bottom of Mount Sinai, receiving the law and being instructed. And then at last they move on. And they move rapidly again to the edges of Canaan, so that in chapter 13 of Numbers you can see that they were ready to explore the promised land. And this is the famous story of pairs of spies being sent out, two from every tribe, to go and see what the land is like. And they come back with a report that says the land is brilliant, but the giants are too big for us to fight. And they rebel against God's decision or command to enter the promised land, with the result that God condemns that generation. In Numbers chapter 14 and verse 22, the people of Israel are told that not one of those who saw my glory and the signs I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to their ancestors, except for Caleb, and later on also Joshua. The whole of that generation will perish during the 40 years that the people of Israel spend wandering in the wilderness before the next generation enters the promised land. And by the time we get to this incident, which we read today in Numbers chapter 20, I think we are right at the end of those 40 years in the wilderness. And the reason I say that is because if you turn to the end of the chapter, in chapter 20, verse 22, it describes the death of Aaron, who was the priest, how he was taken up to the top of a mountain where he died, and the priestly robes were transferred to his son and his successor. And if you tie that together with Numbers chapter 33, verses 7 and 8, where there is a 37 and 38 rather, where there is a summary of the whole of the Israelite journey through the wilderness between Egypt and the promised land, then there in verses 37 and 38 it tells us they left Kadesh, which is where the incident we read in Numbers chapter 20 took place, camped in the borders of Edom, and at the Lord's command Aaron died on the first day of the fifth month of the 40th year after the Israelites came out of Egypt. So the story that we read in Numbers chapter 20, verses 1 to 14, comes in the 40th year of the wilderness wanderings. A time of punishment has just about ended. The renegade, rebellious generation have almost all died, perhaps except for Moses and Aaron themselves. And they are just about to come to the Jordan and enter the promised land. And then we come to this story of them complaining because there was no water to drink. Now, as I also said, this was part of a repeating pattern of rebellion and complaint against the Lord. So if you go right back again to Exodus chapter 15, they've only just crossed through the Red Sea on dry land. You would think they would be celebrating the greatness of God. You would think Moses would wake up the next day saying, "What a relief, we're free at last. We can start building and planning for the future. There is a great vista of hope and possibility opening out in front of us." In Exodus chapter 15, verse 24, the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What are we to drink?" Not, "Thank you for rescuing us from slavery," but, "What are we to drink?" Exodus chapter 16, verses 2 and 3, having been given something to drink, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt, where we sat round pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." And then the pattern continues in Exodus chapter 17 with a story you might recognize almost if you've been paying attention. where the whole Israelite community traveled out from the desert of Sin, traveling from place to place as the Lord commanded, came to Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" But they were thirsty for water and grumbled against Moses. "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to make us and our children and livestock die of thirst?" And Moses cried out to the Lord, "What am I to do with these people? They are ready to stone me." And the Lord answered Moses, "Go out in front of the people. Take some elders of Israel and in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile and go. I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock and water will come out for the people to drink." So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the place Massah and Meribah, testing and quarreling, because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" So what we see is this repeating pattern of grumpy Israelites forgetting the good things that they have just been given, forgetting the bad things they've already been saved from, thinking there is no hope of anything good happening, blaming Moses, and Moses again and again, with the blessing of God at his disposal, providing food and water and pasture and all the things that they had ever needed. And Numbers chapter 20, 40 years on, is almost an exact repetition of Exodus chapter 17, the same thing happening again and again, except this time the story is different. Because this time, after the water has flowed, the Lord turns on Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I give them." What was the problem? Why was Moses condemned in verse 12? Apparently for doing the same thing as he'd done 40 years earlier in chapter 17. Well, if you examine the story carefully, you can certainly see that technically Moses disobeyed God. If you look at verse 8, where Moses is commanded by God, he is told, "Take the staff, gather the assembly together, and speak to the rock, and it will pour out its water." But you read what Moses actually did in verse 11. He took his staff, he gathered the assembly, then he raised his arm and he struck the rock twice with his staff. And the water gushed out. And God could turn round to Moses and say, "I didn't tell you to hit the rock. I just told you to speak to it. You've disobeyed me, you've not recognized me as holy, and therefore I will not let you into the land." So technically Moses disobeyed God, but it seems a pretty harsh judgment, doesn't it? Especially when last time around he had been told to hit the rock and he did and the water flowed. You'd need to be pretty pedantic in the way that you exercise judgment to bring down such a severe exclusion on Moses for this. But what becomes apparent as we see this passage interpreted later on in the Bible is that it was not simply the physical action of striking the rock for which Moses is condemned, but what was on his heart at the time. Look at Psalm 106, which is one of these long psalms that describes the story of Israel during the Exodus. And this incident comes into the psalm in verses 32 and verses 33. It's page 610 of our church Bibles. And says, "By the waters of Meribah, they angered the Lord." That is, the people of Israel angered the Lord, presumably by their unjustified and faithless complaining. "And trouble came to Moses because of them." Well, we got that bit, because Moses got into trouble. We've seen that. And then, as Hebrew poetry very often does, it repeats the same thing using slightly different words to help us understand the point. "By the waters of Meribah, they angered the Lord." How did they anger the Lord in verse 33? "They rebelled against the Spirit of God." They didn't behave in a way that was appropriate for a spirit-filled generation. And trouble came to Moses because of them. Why? In verse 33, because rash words came from Moses' lips. In other words, he spoke out in anger. He spoke in haste. He spoke in a way that communicated his frustration, his anger, his sense of injustice, of being hard done by. He let them see that he really thought he deserved better from them than he was actually being treated. As if Moses was saying to the people of Israel, you know, me and God are angry with you. Me and God have got it right and you've let us down. And those words were judged by the psalmist, certainly, and God as rash and in haste, and led to Moses' condemnation. So why did Moses speak out like that? Why was he so angry, so difficult, so hasty in the way that he spoke? Well, we can see a number of reasons why Moses in this particular occasion might not have been at his best. First of all, he is bereaved. You notice that in chapter 20, verse 1, there Miriam died and was buried, and Miriam is the person that Moses has known longest. He owes his life to her. She was there to welcome him when he came back to Egypt. They traveled across the Red Sea together, and side by side they sang songs of praise to God, his big sister, his perhaps closest friend, and she's just died. And any of us who have ever been bereaved or suffered other times of loss or disappointment or hardship or stress or anything else know that these are the times when we are not at our best and most likely to lose our temper and say things that we later regret. Moses is suffering from personal bereavement. He's also suffering from the aggressive approach of the people who should appreciate the way that he's been looking after them. They didn't just come and say, Moses, we've got a wee bit of a problem here. There's not enough water. Do you think you could do that trick with the rock again, or say some prayers, or go and speak to God, and perhaps together we can sort this out? They came and almost grabbed him by the throat and said, Moses, this is your fault. You're unfeeling, you're uncaring, you haven't thought this through. You've got us into this problem. And you can see the anger on their faces. And understand why Moses gets defensive. And defensive people lash out to counterattack. And also because, as we've already mentioned, this is a repeating pattern. He has helped them before. He solved this problem before. He's taught them to trust the Lord before. He could, if the books of Exodus had been written, he could show them chapter and verse for when this had happened in the past. So it's just a bit wearing to have to go on teaching the same lesson again and again. And he says, come on! Haven't you got it yet? I'm fed up telling you. And also, I guess there is a sense of failure. He is supposed to be their leader. He is trying to take them to the promised land. And when he looks around and sees they're quite right to complain there is no water, he feels bad because things are not working out. And a bit of him, the bit of him that is filled with pride, says it's my fault. They're looking to me as their provider and I've failed them yet again. And that combination of things, I think, explains why Moses lashes out in anger and speaks in ways that are not good enough for God, and which I presume he later regretted. And as you see those factors driving Moses to speak out in the way that he did, then perhaps you can see that anyone could lead God's people, anyone at all. It's a dead easy job. Anyone could lead God's people so long as you were only ever asked to take responsibility when you felt like it, when you were at your best and in the top of your game, and when the people you were being asked to lead were always committed, sensitive, responsible people who who only had to be taught everything once and then remembered it for the rest of time, so that together with you at their head, they always went from strength to strength, from victory to victory. If that was the way it worked, then anyone could be a leader of God's people, even me. But the truth is that leaders are human beings who do go through hard times and are bereaved or disappointed or get out of the wrong side of bed in the morning, or their favourite rugby team gets beaten the night before, or for whatever reason they're in a bad mood from time to time. And yes, you would hope that the people they are meant to be leading would recognise and respect that sometimes they're frail human leaders are not at their best and show some sympathy and respect. But nevertheless, it's these times when we are not at our best that we have the best opportunity to prove the faithfulness of God, to show that it's not my self-confidence, my experience, my leadership skill that is getting us to where we're going to go, but God who is taking us. I don't really feel like it today, but God's kingdom lasts forever. So let's move on hand in hand with him. And the truth is that leaders who are not at their best will also have to lead followers who are human, and human beings don't always behave well. I remember David Lunan, who was moderator of the General Assembly and active in Glasgow Presbytery, saying to me one time when we were talking about negotiations with congregations in times of change. And what he said to me is, frightened people look ugly. What he meant is that when you were going to people and having to explain to them or face them up to something that was going to be challenging or change-making, something they weren't going to like, then people who are frightened by the unknown future you are leading them into look ugly to you. They speak back aggressively. They are rude and they shout at you. And if you can't lead people who look ugly, then you're never going to be able to lead anyone at all. And it's when the grace of God and a leader responds with kindness to shouts, with patience to intolerance, with faithfulness to rebellion, that the glory of God is truly seen in his people. And of course, it's not true that the people we have to work with learn every lesson only ever once, because that's all it takes. We do have to teach them the same thing over and over again. Why? Because that's the nature of sin. Why is faithfulness, faith and faithfulness, such a virtue in the Bible? Because that's what conquers sin. We need the persistent faithfulness of God to defeat the persistent corruption of sin. It's like the moss growing in your back garden. You can spray the moss kill on one year, but next year the moss will be back again. And you've got to do the same thing year after year, time after time, if you want the garden to flourish. So having told them once is not enough. You've got to do it again and again. When I was a student for the minister, I spent time in around half a dozen different congregations, and I'm saying that so that you don't know which one this story is about, because it's not terribly complimentary. But in one of the congregations where I did an assistantship, we had a Bible study and prayer meeting. I think it was on a Tuesday night, and there were about half a dozen people came. And the same night, there was a young women's group that met that had about 40 or 50 people going to it. They were all aged over 55, but they'd been a young women's group at one time, I suppose. And I remember thinking, there's something odd here, 55 doing flower arranging classes at the young women's group and half a dozen at the prayer meeting. And I remember the minister sharing his frustration with me and saying, I don't know why we can't get this congregation to study the Bible and pray together. And then one week he came to me and he said, would you lead the Bible study this week, because I've got something else on? And being young and enthusiastic, I said, of course I would. I'd love to. Where are you going? Is it something important? And he said, well, me and my wife were on holiday in America last year, and the young women's group has asked if I would come and show them my holiday slides. And I thought to myself, I know why that congregation has so few at the prayer meeting. It's because of the way they're being led. They may have been told once or twice or 20 times or 100 times about the importance of Bible study and prayer, but then the lesson had stopped being taught. And the minister was showing that holiday snaps mattered more, and he would let them lead him instead. If we stop teaching the lesson and then blame people for not knowing, then we have underestimated the persistence of sin and failed to represent the faithfulness of God. And of course, we don't always go from strength to strength. Our Christian life as leaders and followers knows success, but also disappointment. Not victory to victory, or at least that's not how it seems to us, but times when we really feel that the world is against us and we don't have the resources to carry on. We haven't done well enough to think highly of ourselves, and so we lose our self-confidence. But if you've been with us on Tuesday evenings when we've been working our way through Paul's letter to the Philippians as part of the Discipleship Explored course, then you will remember what it says in Philippians chapter 3, verse 9, where Paul says, I consider everything I have achieved as so much rubbish, that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not with a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness that comes from God on the basis of faith. So you see, Moses at Kadesh didn't need to say, everywhere I've led you, I've always found water for you. He simply needed to be able to say, everywhere we've gone together, we've always been in the presence of a gracious God. And he has done the right thing for us. And that is where our confidence lies. And here is maybe why it matters in Numbers chapter 20 more than it did in Exodus chapter 17. Because we do have this repeating pattern that every stop along the way where there's not enough water or not enough food or something else is wrong, they turned against Moses. And the thing just happens again and again and again. But when we get to Numbers chapter 20 in the 40th year after the Exodus, all of the people who were there in Exodus chapter 17 are dead, except for Moses and Aaron. So the ones who should have learned and should have remembered and should have known on the basis of their experience were not the people who were complaining, but Moses and Aaron who were being complained against. And here was this new generation for whom God had the highest hopes and the greatest plans, who would cross the River Jordan and walk round the walls of Jericho and fight against the giants and claim the promised land. And God, in his desire to provide them with water, to teach them how he would always nourish them for the rest of their lives, was anxious that their faith should be built up so that they could follow him with faithfulness. And Moses, the man with more experience of God's grace than all the rest of them put together, said to them, do you know what? You're worthless. You're rubbish. You're not good enough for God, and you'll never come to anything. And God said to Moses, you are the kind of leader that I can do without if I am going to bless my people. So Christian maturity doesn't mean that we always feel good. It doesn't mean that we're always surrounded by committed people. It doesn't mean that we never need to learn or teach the same lesson twice, and it doesn't mean that everything works out the way that we want. Christian maturity means that we know God. And that's it. Christian maturity means that we know God. And as we know God, we know how to speak for God, how to follow others for God, and how to lead for God, and how to pave the way to His promised land. But perhaps the best bit of the story is this, that when we have these people whom we rightly condemn because they should have known better, and we have this leader whom God condemns because he should have known better too, and you would say, humanly speaking, this is a situation for which there is no hope. But in verse 11, when Moses raised his arm and disobediently struck the rock twice with his staff, water gushed out, and the community and their livestock drank. You can disobey God as much as you like, but you can't change his love for you. You can stifle him and frustrate him and disobey him as often as you want, but he will carry on nourishing you. He won't leave you or me to die in the desert, however much we deserve, because there is no end to his goodness and his love. So let us thank God that we are able to gather together this evening around a table where he provides us with food and drink, where he feeds us and cares for us in a way that he prepared for us long ago and longs for us to continue to enjoy forever and share with others for the rest of time as we gather in his name.